and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, State Senator Bill Willikowski, economist Greg Erickson, consultant Brad Keithley, and petroleum economist Roger Marks. Moderated by Gunnar Knapp of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and the forum was hosted by Alaska Common Ground. The debate and forum on the oil tax referendum was recorded at the Wilde Marston Theater on July 23rd and edited for broadcast at this time.
Hello. Welcome. Welcome to Alaska Common Ground's forum on ballot measure number one, which is also known as the oil tax referendum and the vote on the proposal to repeal Senate Bill 21. I'm Cliff Groh. I'm the chair of Alaska Common Ground, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization which is dedicated to bringing Alaskans together to learn more about Alaska's important public issues and perhaps even reach consensus. So, I want to introduce our distinguished speakers tonight. We have four distinguished speakers who know what they're talking about on this issue. We have urging a yes vote. We have Alaska State Senator Bill Willikowski and veteran Alaska economist Greg Erickson. On the other hand, urging a no vote, the two gentlemen farther away from me, we have oil and gas policy consultant Brad Keithley, who used to be an oil and gas attorney, and Roger Marks, a longtime Alaska petroleum economist. Later this evening, the moderator will be posing questions to the debaters from the questions that come from the audience. Moderating our debate tonight is Gunnar Knapp, who's professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage and also director of ICER. Take it away, Professor Knapp.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this debate on which is what's obviously a very important topic for Alaskans, judging by this enormous turnout tonight. Now, on August 19th, we Alaskans get to vote on ballot measure one. Yes is a vote to repeal the new MAPA or SB 21 tax law and reinstate the former ACES tax law provisions. No is a vote to keep the new MAPA SB 21 tax law. Now, regardless of the outcome of the vote, the legislature could amend the tax law in the future. So if we, you know, regardless of the way this come out, we're not stuck with either of these laws necessarily, and we could go on and alter what we have. Both of these laws are very complex, and it would take more time than we have for the entire debate this evening to even begin to explain all the details of both laws. And so what follows is an extremely simplified introduction to some of the most important features and differences of them. And there's many, many other important features and differences, and I'm sure the debaters will point some of those out. One thing that both of these laws have in common is that they both tax oil producers' profits. Now, what are profits? It's the value of the oil production minus the costs of the oil production, or certain costs. What are those costs? They include transportation costs, deductible operating costs, and deductible capital costs. And some kinds of costs aren't deductible. Now, for both of these tax laws, the producers pay a tax rate on their profits, and they can deduct credits. So the taxes that they actually pay is the profits times the tax rate minus the credits. Now, the profits are calculated in the same way for both laws. What's different is the tax rate and the credits are calculated differently. Under the ACES tax law, the tax rate rises as the profit per barrel or profitability per barrel increases. If profitability per barrel is very low, then the tax rate is as low as 25%. If it gets very high, it can theoretically go up to as high as 75%. In contrast, under MAPA, the new tax law, the tax rate is fixed at 35%. Basically, this is a sort of picture showing how, as the profits per barrel increases, for a certain level of profits per barrel, the ACES tax rate is lower than the MAPA tax rate. At a certain point, they're equal, and at a certain point above that profits per barrel level, then the ACES tax rate is higher. Another thing that differs is that the credits are calculated differently under ACES and MAPA. So ACES gives producers credits for capital costs. MAPA gives producers credits for production. And the credit calculations for both laws are way too complicated for me to explain the details of how all this works. Another important feature difference is that MAPA provides a tax reduction for so-called new oil, and that's called the gross value reduction, or GVR. And again, what new oil is and how this GVR is calculated, that's complicated too. And part of the debate is about the regulations that have been written to define new oil. And finally, I'm going to finish by showing you some historical trends in three critical factors which will affect oil revenues under either tax going forward. And these are production, prices, and costs. And so part of the debate is what's going to happen to production prices and costs going forward. This is looking back and going through last fiscal year. So here's been the trend in our North Slope oil production. I think all of us are aware that we've experienced this very significant decline from 2 million barrels per day down to whatever it was, just a little over 500 million in 2013. FY 2013. Here is the trend in average annual oil prices paid on the North Slope. And I think one thing that is clearly very important is we experienced this very dramatic increase in oil prices over the past 6 or 7 years. Another thing to note about that is that prices fluctuate more than annually. They fluctuate daily. They fluctuate monthly and often significantly. And finally, another factor is costs. And the North Slope producers' annual deductible cost per barrel, as reported by the Alaska Department of Revenue based on the producers' tax filings, have increased quite significantly since 2007. And so those are simply trends in these three important variables that are part of what will affect how these taxes might affect us going forward. And with that, I'm done, and we can begin the debate. And so I would like to invite Senator Wilikowski to go first. Senator, you have 5 minutes. Thanks.
Good evening. It's our oil. You've all heard that, but what does that mean? Governor Wally Hickel talked often about Alaska being an owner state. We all own the oil and minerals in the ground. I remember a story he used to tell. It was 1967. ARCO had drilled a number of dry holes. They were getting ready to pull out of Alaska. Governor Hickel famously urged them to drill at Prudhoe Bay, saying, "You drill or I will." The surprised ARCO geologist said, "Are you serious?" He said, quote, "You're damn right I will. It's our land and it's our oil." When questioned, sadly, our new philosophy today appears to be, "You drill or we will give you massive tax breaks with no strings attached." That's not acting like a sovereign. That's not acting like an owner state. Let's review the historical record. For roughly 30 years, we had a tax structure called the ELF. We had some of the lowest tax rates in the world. The oil companies persuaded us that if we had these low tax rates, we'd have more production, more jobs, more investment. By 2006, 15 out of 19 fields had a 0% tax rate. How did it work? Production plummeted from 2 million barrels a day to 858,000 barrels a day by 2006. Jobs declined, investment declined. Alaska lost hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue. The oil industry was pumping out huge amounts of oil from Alaska and reinvesting in places like Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez was charging them a 95% tax rate, Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was charging them a 95% tax rate, Russia, 90% tax rate, Kazakhstan, 90% tax rate. We finally said enough is enough in 2007. We passed ACEs. We said, if you're going to simply harvest our oil, we're going to get our fair share. But if you're going to act as a partner and reinvest here, we're going to give you the most generous tax credits and breaks in the world. Did it work? Well, you've all heard the millions of dollars in TV radio ads saying nobody wanted to invest under ACEs. False. Investment by oil companies skyrocketed, 70% to all-time highs. You heard the oil ads about how jobs left Alaska. False. All-time highs in jobs under ACEs every single year, although the oil companies were hiring 50% of the people from outside of Alaska. You heard the oil company ads about companies fleeing Alaska. False. The number of companies filing tax returns in Alaska increased 383% under ACEs. You heard that Alaska wasn't profitable. False. The oil industry made over $40 billion in profits under ACEs. If you put your money in the bank, you're lucky if you get a 1% rate of return. The rate of return under ACEs on the North Slope, according to the Parnell experts, over 55%. The rate of return at Prudhoe Bay, 123%. Compare that to Norway, 15%. Canada, 15%. Oh, and North Dakota, 25%. ConocoPhillips executives admitted in 2011 in an investor conference call that Alaska has, quote, strong cash margins and offers, quote, very good rates of return. A couple weeks later, the CEO for ConocoPhillips flew to Alaska and said, Alaska's a terrible place to do business. Give us billions of dollars in tax breaks. So what about production? Alaska has sadly become a warehouse for the oil industry. We issue leases, and currently over 1,000 of them sit idle. Look at Point Thompson, one of the largest undeveloped oil and gas reserves in North America. Exxon sat on that lease for 30 years. Finally, we said enough is enough and yanked their lease. Mr. Keithley was their attorney. They wanted to continue to warehouse our oil and gas. And today they're spending billions because we finally acted like a sovereign and said, it's our oil. You drill or we will. Is SB 21 a giveaway? We would have lost $8.5 billion over the 7 years we had. Is SB 21 leading to more production? Governor Parnell is projecting a 45% decline under SB 21. SB 21 took us back to a failed policy. It's time we started acting like an owner state. It's our oil. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brad Keithley, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Gunnar. Well, I can't out-shout him, but I'll try to out-reason him. There's one thing that this side and our side agrees on. Alaska is facing a very difficult fiscal future, financial future. In the last 2 years, we have run back-to-back the two largest deficits, budget deficits in Alaska's history. 2 years ago, the budget deficit was $1.9 billion. Last year, the current year we're in, it's estimated that the budget deficit will be $1.6 billion. In the last 2 years, we've drained $6 billion. That's over 33% out of the state's savings. At that rate, we don't have enough money to last us through the enough savings to last us through the end of the decade. But that's not SB 21's fault. Here's what ICER said at the beginning of 2013 when ACEs was still in effect and based upon revenue forecasts under ACEs. Right now, the state is on a path it can't sustain. Reasonable assumptions suggest we do not have enough cash in reserves to avoid a severe fiscal crunch soon after 2023, And with that fiscal crisis will come an economic crash. That is the direction that the state was headed before we had back-to-back the two largest deficits in the state's history, and before, in the last 2 years, we drained $6 billion out of the state's cash reserves. The question going forward is not who can out-argue the other. The question going forward is rationally what's in Alaska's best interest to get our fiscal house back in order. One, we have to reduce spending. ICER said in the 2013 report, what can the state do to avoid a major fiscal and economic crisis? The answer is to save more and restrict the rate of spending growth. All revenues above the sustainable spending level of $5.5 billion should be channeled into savings. What did the state spend that year that ICER issued the 5.5 report? The state spent $7.2 billion. ICER then took that into account and dropped the revenues and took into account the deficit and recalculated. And they said for this current fiscal year, the state should be spending $5 billion unrestricted general fund. What did the state agree to spend this year? $6.2 billion. The state can't keep going down this track. We have to reduce spending. But then the question is, what do we do on the revenue side? And looking at the long term, coldly calculating where this state's going, where this revenue is going to come from, if you look at the testimony that was delivered during SB 21, if you look at the economic analysis that was delivered at SB 21, over the long term, over the next 30 years, and that's what we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about ourselves, our kids, our grandkids, and future generations. Over the long term, SB 21 produces more revenue for the state than ACES does if SB 21 results in an investment level that bends the decline curve by just 1%. We're on a 6% decline curve. We've been on a 6% decline curve for a long time. What we need to do is bend that decline curve, reduce the decline curve as much as we can by bringing additional investment, getting additional oil produced. ACES ran 5 years, and it didn't do it. There was a lot of money spent. There was a lot of money wasted going after fields that have never shown productivity and never will produce because producers got tax credits for doing it. But it didn't bring additional production. It didn't bend the decline curve. That's what we need to be talking about. SB 21 is a rational, reasoned, logical, well-thought-out approach to try to find a way to bring additional investment to this state. SB 21 is a way to try to bend the decline curve in a way that brings longer-term revenue to the state. And if we do it just by 1% at certain prices and by 2% at other prices, if we do it, then we're going to have more revenue for the long term of this state. That's what we need to be concerned about. We don't need to be concerned about it's our oil, are we nationalistic, can we do something about it? We need to be concerned rationally about long-term revenue, and SB 21 is the correct way to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg Erickson.
Well, Brad, I have to say that one thing this panelist doesn't agree with is this notion that there's these scary deficits. There are deficits, but they're not nearly as big as the ones you say. And if you guys would like to ask me a question about that, I'll explain it. But in FY13, the state earned $5 billion on its investments. And all of that was available for appropriation by the legislature, and Mr. Keithley doesn't count a penny of that. So I'd like to make two points. First of all, the big difference between ACES and SB 21 is what happens at high prices. If oil prices rise from $120 a barrel to $140 a barrel, the oil companies didn't do anything to deserve that windfall. It's a windfall. And under ACES, Alaska gets a very big chunk of that, 75%, and it should get 90%. But under the More Alaska Production Act, That's not what happens. Under SB 21, the oil companies get the biggest share, a much larger share of that increment. So I have to say that the people in the spin doctors at the Parnell administration, or more likely at the oil companies or among their consultants, who thought up the name More Alaska Production Act, were really brilliant, because it implies that the real issue here is whether or not SB 21 elicits more production. Well, I believe in incentives. I'm an economist, and I think most of the people who, or maybe all the people who are supporting the referendum believe in it as well. And reducing the tax rate does increase the likelihood that more investments will flow into Alaska, and investments do increase the likelihood that there will be some more production. But the real question isn't whether there'll be more production, it's whether Alaska's better off as a consequence of that. And every analysis that has been done of the elasticity of production to changes in tax rate show very clearly that production is very inelastic to changes in tax rate. And in fact, an analysis presented to the legislature in 2012 by Professor Shelby Gerken showed pretty conclusively, and he did a meta-analysis of 20 other studies, shows pretty conclusively that the gains from the kind of tax reduction that was actually implemented in SB 21 at even moderate prices of, say, $105 a barrel, are only about 1/20 of what is lost to the state from the tax reductions in SB 21. Now, it's those ability to capture the windfall revenues at high prices that made it possible for Alaska to stash away $17 billion. It's what made it possible for us to have the resources to work towards diversifying Alaska's economy, to educate our children the way they should be educated, and to ensure that Alaska has a future if and when oil production does decline, as it inevitably will eventually, whether sooner or later. So, the second point, and I did a handout on this out at the front desk, and you can get a copy of it. The second point I make, and I'll make it very briefly, is that there's been a lot of discussion about production decline recently. There's lots of evidence has accumulated that production decline is the result of manipulations by the oil companies. And if you look back at the history of production decline, you see that they did exactly the same thing when ACES and reserves tax on gas was under consideration. So pick up a copy of this handout, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that later on in the debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger Marks.
Thank you. How's the sound there? Good? Okay. Thank you, Gunnar. First of all, I'd like to thank Common Ground, the other sponsors, for hosting this event and for the invite. Back in 1962, when the state was trying to figure out how to develop its North Slope resources, or even if it had North Slope resources, it could have started its own state-owned oil company, and it talked about that. But instead, it decided to open up its resources to the world through the competitive bidding lease system. The experience, expertise, and capital of multinational corporations would come here to explore and develop. Development would proceed from market forces, and as far as taxes were concerned, what a fair share of revenue would be what you can get in a competitive environment. Oil does not produce itself. Whether it's old oil or new oil, it needs capital. Capital is limited. This capital has lots of opportunities. Capital goes to where it gets the best deal, and jurisdictions have to compete for it. SB 21 was propagated by one single big problem with ACES, and the problem was the progressivity and structure embedded in ACES created very high tax rates at high prices. At times, the marginal tax rate exceeded 90%. That means when the price went up a dollar, 90 cents of that dollar went to the government. This was way outside international norms. This eliminated nearly all upside price potential for the producers, the opportunity to make somewhat more money when prices are higher. Upside price potential is important, number one, because number one, it offsets low price risk. Number two, even if high prices are of relatively low probability, if you can make a lot of money when they happen, it can make development worthwhile. And number three, most important, producers get to realize upside price potential nearly everywhere else. One of the statistics economists use to measure fiscal systems is government take. Government take is how much money goes to the government as a percentage of the pre-tax profit. At the time ACES was in effect, relative to the places Alaska competes with, the government take was 10 to 15 percentage points higher in Alaska. That means producers could earn $1.5 to $2 billion more investing elsewhere after tax. Now, even SB 21 has a government take that's a little higher than international norms, but it's much more in line than ACES was. So producers can make much more money investing nearly anywhere else in Alaska. So why would they want to do business here? Even if it was profitable, it was just so much more profitable elsewhere. And Alaska paid the price. Since 2007, oil prices have gone from a $60 per barrel world to $120 per barrel world. Now, investment in Alaska went up some, in real terms about 15%, but it should have gone up much more. The rate of increase in capital investment in Alaska relative to the rest of the world was just a fraction of what occurred elsewhere. In the lower 48 and the rest of the world, the long-term trends of production decline and reserves decline reversed themselves during this time period, but not in Alaska. The irony here was as prices got higher and higher, Alaska became less and less competitive, and we actually got less oil. As a result, under ACES, the forecast for production in 10 years was just 300,000 barrels a day going through taps, 200,000 barrels a day in 15 years. Now, where the Constitution says resources are to be used for the maximum benefit of the people, surely that must mean future generations as well. The oil is clearly there. If you look at USGS or DNR estimates, there's a tremendous amount of additional oil to be recovered. This is conventional oil in the central North Slope, much of it in existing fields. It's impossible to calculate how much exactly additional production there would be with a competitive tax. But at high prices, where ACES has higher rates, it only takes the additional production from a small portion of that reserve base that USGS and DNR have estimated. Just takes additional production from a small portion of that reserve base under SB 21 to get more revenues than under ACES. There's been a flurry of activity since passage of SB 21, and for the second time in 26 years, in the fiscal year that just ended, there was no production decline. But in the long term, we have just never seen what might get unleashed if you have high oil prices exceeding $100 a barrel coupled with a competitive tax. If producers can earn here what they earn in other places, they should invest here like they invest in other places. Thank you, and I look forward to examining these and other issues this evening.
Thank you. Now we're going to move into the second phase of the debate with these two teams questioning each other. We're going to begin with 16 minutes of the supporters questioning the opponents. That means that Senator Wilkowski and Greg Erickson will be asking questions of Brad Keithley and Roger Marks. Once more, a reminder of how that works. The questioners will get 1 minute to ask their question. Respondents get 2 minutes to respond. Then the questioners get a brief for rebuttal if they wish, and then we move on to the next question. Hopefully each side will get in 4 or 5 questions each 16 minutes. So, gentlemen.
In the last full year of ACES, the state made $6.3 billion in revenue from the oil industry. One of the things we were promised, was that if SB 21 passed, there would be a trade-off of short-term revenue decline for long-term gain. Would you be surprised that the governor in his latest revenue forecast, after consulting with the oil industry, is now projecting that we've gone from a $6.3 billion revenue stream in 2013 to a $3.3 billion revenue forecast for 2023, nearly a 50% drop in revenue projected in 2023.
Bill, this is the question of the governor's forecast. The governor's forecasts are predicated upon projects that are in place, projects that are under the drill bit, that are being developed, that are going forward. The old system that Greg criticized and the old system that over-forecast production did put in some pie in the sky. It did put in, it assumed that every project hit. And so we had a series of years in which production forecasts were excessive, were above whatever happened, because we were assuming too much. The new system that's been put in is much more realistic. It takes things as they go. It takes investments as they go. It takes projects as they go and builds up. So the same thing that's going on the production side, you criticize SB21 for resulting in low production. The same thing that's going on the production side is going on the revenue side. We haven't seen the impact of the SB21 investments. We won't see the impact of the SB21 investments until there's drill bits going in the ground, until there's infrastructure put in place, until the oil's ready to go, until the projects are completed. So this it's the same thing. The governor's projections are predicated, whether revenue or production, the governor's projections are predicated on a standard that is requiring that things be done. And until those steps are taken, we're not going to see the benefits of it.
Well, if that's true, isn't it true that the drop if the oil company argument has been, and the rads we're hearing on the radio, is that SB21 has produced an increase in activity. So you're saying that's not true? Aren't the oil companies lying about that then?
Is that a question I can respond to?
Sure, go ahead. Take my time.
whatever time you had. No, the oil companies aren't lying. We haven't seen the investments, the products of the investments that the oil companies are making. We haven't seen in the forecasts, and remember the forecasts are made back in October, we haven't seen the benefits of those forecasts yet. Some of those projects were announced after the first of the year. Some of the projects are on the drawing board. We are trying to evaluate these things too quickly about where the investment is going to produce results.
Well, just to clarify, the forecasts weren't done in October. They were done in April. They were done just a couple months ago, and they show a 45% decline in production and a 47% decline in revenue. That's the forecast.
April 19, 2014.
The April forecast, Gunnar, if I may, the April forecast is merely an update of the October forecast. The April forecast adjusts the October forecast for actuals. It doesn't adjust it for additional investment. It doesn't adjust it for additional projects. It's merely an update for actual production that's occurred between October and April.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next question. Thanks.
Our turn for next question. Yeah. I said before, and it's real important, the big problem with SB21 is that it loses us that upside windfall potential if oil prices rise really dramatically. And it pushes that money, as Senator Stedman says, across the table to the oil companies. The Parnell administration's own numbers show that if SB21 had been in effect since 2007, if we went back and had applied it back in 2007 instead of ACES, the state would have had $8.5 billion less revenue over that period. Now, it's that revenue that provided the wherewithal that gave us $17 billion of savings. Let me just ask the gentleman here, wouldn't Alaska be in a much more dire position if it had adopted SB21 instead of ACES in 2007?
The reason all the money came in under ACES was because there was all the captive investment up there that couldn't go anywhere else, and so production continued and paid the tax, but Alaska paid the price. The price we're seeing is 300,000 barrels a day in 2023, and 5 years later, 200,000 barrels a day if you continue the decline curve.
Well,
and then if you believe a competitive tax will not affect investment and production, it means we're stuck with 300,000 barrels a day in 2023 and 200,000 barrels a day in 2028. And that's a very, very grim future, either way.
No, you know, the one problem with debating this with these folks is that they never will give us an analysis that really pins down what they think the impact on production will be. I've given my analysis. It's in the handout. It shows what I think, shows how I gathered that, made that reasoning. If Roger has other analysis that he thinks refutes that, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see anybody give an analysis of what they expect the bang for the buck to be, these billions of dollars, or hundreds of millions of dollars that we're giving away under SB 21. What's that buying us? Nobody will tell you. All you have are these qualitative statements that, oh, it'll produce a lot of drilling and a lot of oil.
Can I respond to that, Gunnar? Or? Well, what you have is a sensitivity analysis that shows how much additional oil under SB 21 it takes to make more money. And the answer is, if you can produce 5% of the resource base, you're ahead of the game. So the question is increasing the resource base 5% plausible or not? I believe it is. It's very attainable.
Yeah, and under my next question, and you seem to be the only person that thinks that, because Governor Parnell, BP, and ConocoPhillips all disagree with you. ConocoPhillips made $14.4 billion in profits under ACES, and Exxon and BP are estimated to have made roughly the same. That's over $43 billion. Total in 7 years under ACES. Alaskan oil and gas routinely makes up about 13% of ConocoPhillips' worldwide production, yet from this 13%, ConocoPhillips routinely makes up over 33% of their worldwide profits in Alaska under ACES. According to our legislative research department, ConocoPhillips' global profits per barrel average was about $16 per barrel. In Alaska, it was $31 per barrel, nearly double its worldwide profits per barrel under ACES. Would you agree that Alaska was a very profitable place to do business under ACES?
That's a misleading statistic. When they report those figures, the profit is on a per BTU basis that combines their profits from oil or gas together. In Alaska, they're about 100% oil, and the rest of the world is 50% oil and gas. Oil prices are very, very much higher than gas prices, and so just the fact that the mixture of oil and gas is different here than elsewhere is the reason you have that number. They can't report just oil because it's a joint operation, but it's very clear that if you looked at the profits for oil, Alaska would be very low compared to the rest of the world. Just as an example, if you look at ConocoPhillips, they report their earnings, their Alaska earnings, distinctly from their other assets around the world. If you look at how prices have bounced around between 2007 and the present, you'll see when the price goes up, their earnings stay the same. Why? Because 90% of any change in price goes to the government. They just can't make any more money here than what they did when oil prices were down about $70.
Well, I'll give you the exact numbers of Alaska versus the lower 48. 2010, they made $1.7 billion in Alaska. They made $1 billion in lower 48. 2011, they made $2 billion in profit in Alaska. They made $1.3 billion in the entire lower 48. That's including Texas, that's including North Dakota, that's including Oklahoma. In 2012, they made $2.3 billion in Alaska. They made $1 billion in the entire lower 48 and Latin America. $2.3 billion in profits in Alaska in 2013, $1 billion in the entire lower 48 and Latin America. You can look at the average for the last 12 years, which includes high spikes for gas, which and what you see in Alaska is for the, since 2000. So it's
Thank you. Next question.
Gentlemen, I'd like you to look at the chart I passed out that shows the decline rates and the little blurb on comparing the decrease in output before voters voted on tax changes or legislators boosted or changed the tax rates. Back in 1989, Roger, when you and I were both working to get a change to the ELF to take more money, get higher taxes from the companies that own Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik, you might remember that they, ARCO said that they were going to suspend Hurl States development, one of those satellite fields that Mr. Keithley was talking about. But quietly after the legislature passed the ELF changes that Roger and I worked for, and many other people did, they quietly went ahead with the Hurl State development. They did the same thing in 99 when there was no decline after 99. I see I'm out of time. My question is, isn't it true that we're seeing similar kind of manipulation as shown on this chart right now?
Well, the situation on ELF back in 1989 needs to be looked at carefully. The change that was made in 1989 was big fields pay high taxes, little fields pay little taxes. It was based on field size. Now, prior to 1989, a passage of that, I had never heard the term satellite field. And after ELF passed in 89, that's all I heard. What happened was there was an incredible amount of investment in the small fields. It took investment away from the big fields. And what you saw was absolutely classic. There was decline in the high tax fields and increased production in the low tax field. It followed all classical principles of what happens with taxation. Now your graph here, I mean, the first thing I notice is the drastic decline in production since ACES came in 2007. That's the first thing to notice. And what I don't understand is what you mean by log scale on here and how that is different from the linear. So I really can't comment beyond that.
Well, Roger, it's a log of the barrels per day. But let me ask you, let me suggest this, that the efforts by the producers to awfulize production figures in the period leading up to a major vote on petroleum taxes is what's represented here. That sets the stage for an offsetting increase later. And if the effort to scare legislators is successful, as it was in 2013, the reduced production before the vote sets the stage for an I told you so increase later. If the effort is unsuccessful, in the case of ACES, the public is unlikely to care one way or the other.
Okay, thank you very much. And now it's time to move into our final round of questioning. This time, questions from the opponents for the supporters.
I want to go back to the ICER analysis that was done at the beginning of 2013, and that's the one that said, under ACES, right now the state is on a path it can't sustain. Reasonable assumptions suggest we do not have enough cash and reserves to avoid a severe fiscal crunch soon after 2023, and with that fiscal crisis will come an economic crash. And the $5 billion that Greg earlier said wasn't taken into account, that's the permanent fund income.
No.
So what he is suggesting is taking the permanent fund income in and helping to supplement the current general fund. Here's the question. The question is, SB 21 was done in a way to give us a chance to produce additional revenue to get us out of that cycle that we're in, to get us out of the cycle that puts us in a fiscal crisis with an economic crash. What do you suggest we do, if not SB 21, what do you suggest we do to respond to what ICER is telling us is coming ahead?
I'm glad you asked that. I actually have a bill that I think does exactly what we've had. Unfortunately, I can't get the Republicans in the legislature to hear it. They won't even have a hearing on it. Here's what needs to happen. And here's the important thing to remember. Tax rates have very little to do with production increases or decreases. Every national study shows that. In Prudhoe Bay, we had lowest taxes in the world. Production plummeted. Kuparuk, we had some of the lowest taxes. We went from 12% down to 0%. Production declined 7% a year at a time when oil prices tripled. Cook Inlet, 0% tax rate, 99% decline. Low taxes don't lead to more investment. So what do we do? Well, let's look at countries where they're doing things that are working. Norway. Norway has a tax rate much higher than Alaska. It's a constant 78%, right? What do they do? How are they able to get oil companies to produce there? They're producing huge amounts of oil. Well, first of all, when they're issuing the leases, they don't just give it to the person, the company that pays the most for the lease. They give it to the company that says, we're going to invest it in a, we're going to invest and produce that lease in a way that's best for the people of Norway. That's what we need in Alaska, a leases that produce in the best interest of the people of Alaska. No more of this sitting on our leases. That's number one. Number two, let's co-invest. Let's co-invest. We've got $10, $12 billion in the bank. It's bleeding quick. We lost $2 billion just last year. We're losing billions because of this tax break. Let's stop the bleeding and instead start investing with the oil industry. That's what they do in Norway. Let's go out and seismically test the fields so that we know the caliber of the fields and give that information, make it public so that the oil companies know what they're bidding on. We need to change fundamentally the way we have our relationship with the oil industry. It's got nothing to do with tax rates, folks. Nothing to do with tax rates. This is a pure and simple giveaway.
Let's go back to ACES and use the money of the next windfall to help diversify the state's economy. That's a big part of what we should do.
Oh, goody, more fish plants and grain silos. Now, as much as Bill wants his bill to be heard, there's a reason the bill hasn't been heard. That's because the legislature we have and the legislature we're going to have after this election isn't going to hear the bill. They just aren't going to hear the bill. They're not going to make those changes. So we have to be realistic. We have to be practical. Folks, we're heading toward a fiscal cliff.
Not going to hear your bill.
And we have to be practical in dealing with what we're addressing. And what we're addressing is a situation in which revenues are in decline. What SB 21 was an approach to try to get revenues to start increasing, a thought-out, well-analyzed, well-constructed approach to get revenues to start increasing. ICER says, based upon where we were with ACES, right now the state is on a path it can't sustain. Reasonable assumptions suggest
it's time for your next question.
Cash and reserves.
Thank you. Time for your next question.
So let's talk about progressivity a little bit, kind of the cornerstone of the referendum, the cornerstone of ACES, and reflect on it. What progressivity means is high taxes at high prices and low taxes at low prices. Now, in Alaska, because of royalties, which are based on gross, property taxes, which are based on cost, and the minimum tax, the state has a high take at low prices. For example, royalties. Some of the fields out in the MPRA, or more costly fields, are going to their costs are going to exceed $50 a barrel. Now, but with a royalty at 12.5% of gross, the royalty is going to be 30% to 40% of net. So under ACES, not only do we have high tax rates at high prices, we have high tax rates at low prices, and in between as well. This is not progressivity. In terms of the risk-reward balance, this is a distorted system. Most jurisdictions do not have progressivity. Now, we mentioned Norway. Norway has a flat 78% tax. Two things about Norway. Number one, no royalty. If oil prices go, producers have complete downside price protection there.
You need to move to your question.
How do we justify a system with only progressivity on the high end?
Well, Roger, I guess I would look back to 2005, 2006, when you were working for the Murkowski administration on the PPT, and you were a big advocate for progressivity at that time. I was just talking to Marty Rutherford, the Deputy Commissioner of Natural Resources at the time, and she said in the councils of that administration, you were a big advocate for progressivity. The way I justify progressivity is the same way I assume you did at that time. That is that those increases in price weren't because of any thing the oil companies did, so we don't need to encourage any the oil companies by giving them a bigger chunk of that. The oil companies under, when we were considering ELF, the oil companies themselves wanted a more progressive system, and they pointed out, as you did, that the royalty is not a progressive part of the system. The royalty isn't changed under either ACES or the SB21, so that's my answer. Do you have anything to add there?
I just want to comment to what Brad said before about the legislature not hearing my bill. If the legislature won't hear a bill to fix a broken system, then you guys are going to get a chance to change that in November.
Progressivity works when it's progressive on the high end and progressive on the low end, meaning downside protection for the producers. SB 21, and this really hasn't been emphasized enough, the per barrel credits and the gross value reduction that occur that are based on gross were explicitly designed to level out the government take at the low end, and so there's a very steady government take across all prices, and producers are much better protected at low prices than they were under ACES.
Can I respond to that briefly? So here's the deal that was made when we passed ACES. We had a gross tax structure. They got taxed regardless of whether they made a profit or not. And what the oil industry said was, we don't want that. We only want to get taxed if we make a profit. What business in the world wouldn't like that, right? So we said, okay, here you go. But in exchange, we're going to take more at the high end, right? So they got the low end, and now they come back a few years later and said, we want the high end also. And that leaves Alaskans high and dry. And that's not a good deal for Alaska. That's not being an owner state. That's not acting like we should. That's not acting like a sovereign.
Did you guys want to respond to that? You can respond to that, or you can go on to the next question. Okay,
next. I mean, this is the response. We're dealing with reality, right? We're dealing with a failing fiscal situation. We're dealing with a situation that ICER says we do not have enough cash and reserves to avoid a severe fiscal crunch. That's the reality. The question is, how do you respond to that? First, you have to cut spending, but the second is you have to find ways to increase revenue. ACES is leading us into a fiscal crisis. SB 21 was designed in a way to produce additional investment, to produce additional production. I had to go to the dentist yesterday, so if I start slurring, excuse me. Produce additional production and produce additional revenue. That's the design of SB 21. It deals with reality. It's nice to say it's our oil and be nationalistic. It's nice to say they ought to be doing this, they ought to be doing that. But we have to deal with reality. We don't have a whole lot of time yet left before we have to deal with reality. Gunnar, I think we're up. Is our last question?
That's your last question?
Okay, and we're going to cede that to the audience because I think we've run out of things that we productively can do amongst ourselves, so let's hear from what the audience has to ask.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with State Senator Bill Wilikowski, economist Greg Erickson, consultant Brad Keithley, and petroleum economist Roger Marks. Moderated by Gunnar Knapp of the Institute of Social and Economic Research and hosted by Common Ground. The debate and forum on the oil tax referendum was recorded at the Wilda Marston Theater on July 23rd and was edited for broadcast at this time. The full debate is on our website at alaskapublic.org.
Now, I understand that we have 174 questions. Luckily, we
I'm
have
ready to until, stay all night, Gunnar.
Until 2:45 a.m. These folks have agreed to stay. So, seriously... We can only, unfortunately, address a fraction of the huge number of questions we've gotten. I'll try to go through some of these. You'll notice that some of the questions appear to have a bias towards one side. Some might have a bias towards the other side. I'll try, as I go through these questions, to be reasonably balanced in my choice. And some are questions that are
pretty much oriented towards one set of speakers. Some are for all speakers. So I'm going to start with this one. I am particularly concerned about the legislative process that led to the passage of SB 21 with little transparency to the public by votes of legislators with vested interest in the oil industry from redistricting ruled later to be unconstitutional. Please comment for and against this process. So I'd like first to invite the Greg and Bill to respond, and then Roger and Brad, and I'll give you each a minute or...
Okay, we'll go first. I covered that as a reporter, that legislative session, and although I didn't cover specifically the oil tax issue, I was very close to the efforts of the reporters who did. It was not a transparent process. Senator Kathy Geisel didn't even tell her own Republican committee members give him a peek at the committee substitute that she unveiled on the day that it passed out. There were a lot of experiences like that. Bill, do you want to add anything?
You know, what can I say? The first committee referral in the Senate was chaired by an executive at ConocoPhillips. The second committee of referral in the Senate was chaired by someone whose husband does work with the oil industry. The third committee was chaired by someone who works at ConocoPhillips. In the House, it was heard in by an employee who works for ConocoPhillips. You know, the conflict rules need to be changed, and I don't mean to besmirch anyone. The conflict rules need to be changed. It's as simple as that. If you work for an employer who stands to make billions of dollars, you shouldn't be voting on the bill, period. You just shouldn't.
I think you know, Hollis French addressed this issue, and you know, Hollis is certainly someone who did not like SB 21, and I would bet he's going to vote yes on this. But what he said, you know, he's been a senator for a long time. He said, "What we have is a citizen legislature, part-time legislatures who all have jobs, and conflicts are inevitable, and everyone's going to have a potential conflict from time to time." And as long as the conflicts are disclosed, the process is working. And there's nothing wrong with them working on these issues. Otherwise, and this is me now and not Hollis, otherwise, if these legislators don't vote, their constituents don't get represented. Now, ultimately, these legislators are responsible to their voters who know exactly who they work for. And there's another aspect to this issue. You know, part of this whole ACES versus SB 21 issue is an issue of short-term revenue, short-term spending versus long-term revenue. There are a number of interests that benefit from short-term spending, and I'm not going to mention them, but you can just figure out who they are. And there are lots of association between those interests and a lot of legislators that do not get explicitly disclosed, but and are not as exactly direct, but those relationships are certainly there and they matter.
With due respect, Roger, that's the kind of innuendo I don't think we need to have. If you have indications that somebody is improperly profiting from their vote or stands to profit their association to an interest group, you ought to disclose it. Let's not just lay those kind of innuendos on the table.
I think there's no, I'm going to pass on that.
Okay. This person asks, isn't it true that shale oil development in the U.S. and overseas can reduce investment in Alaska significantly regardless of the outcome of the ballot initiative? If so, wouldn't it make sense to get the most revenue possible from existing fields? I'd like to give each of you a chance to respond to that questioner. Why don't you?
Yeah. The Mr. Keithley said at a legislative hearing in August, an interim hearing, that the ballyhooed investment announcements aimed at bolstering support for SB 21 is not going to bring the level of investment to Alaska that we need to offset the decline. And I'm reading this, this is a paraphrase from an article in the Alaska Dispatch by Pat Forgey, January 2nd of this year. And basically, Mr. Keithley said, we got to cut spending regardless of what happens on the oil taxes. So I guess that's one of those confounding influences that could make it useless for us to retain SB 21, and which suggests that the benefits that they're talking about aren't going to materialize.
Thank you.
We do have to cut spending regardless. We cannot maintain under ACES or SB 21. Under any scenario under ACES or SB 21, we cannot maintain the level of spending that the state's currently engaged in. We just don't have the money. It's like I get $100,000 or whatever an income is, and I'm trying to spend $200,000. We don't have the revenue to sustain the level of spending that we've been engaged in. But that's not the end of the analysis. The analysis is, okay, what do we do about it? And we do two things about it. One, we've got to cut spending. And two, we've got to find ways to increase revenue. And SB 21 is designed to produce greater long-term revenue than ACES has. ACES is leading us into a situation where the state is on a path it can't sustain, and leading us into a situation where we have fiscal crisis and economic crash in our future. SB 21 is designed to respond to that and increase long-term revenue for the state. That's what we need to do, and we need to stay the course with where we're headed.
Well, I gather Mr. Keithley's prescription is to not have the future crisis, to have it right now, to cut spending by 35% and cause the economy to take a huge nosedive, and so we'll see a bunch of for sale signs on property around town. I don't think that's what most Alaskans want.
That happens either way, Greg. Let's get serious. Let's not get into nationalism here. Let's get serious. Under ACES, we are headed toward an economic crash. It doesn't get cured by SB 21 alone. We have to do something else. If we don't do it now, then our children and our grandchildren are going to be paying what ICER says our institution of broad-based tax, that's either sales or income tax, and use of a portion of the earnings of the permanent fund. That's where we're headed, under ACES or under SB 21. The question is, what improves our situation going forward? SB 21 does. The analysis that was done in connection with SB 21 shows that with a very slight response to increased investment, that SB 21 produces greater long-term revenues. That's where we need to be going. That's what we need to do to get this state's fiscal situation in better shape.
We're almost done with the question they were answering, which I'm going to give Roger a chance to respond to very briefly, is, isn't it true that shale oil development in the U.S. and overseas can reduce investment in Alaska significantly regardless of the outcome of the ballot initiative? If so, wouldn't it make sense to get the most revenue possible from existing fields? And I'll just let Roger get his 2 cents in on that, and then move on.
The reason shale oil exploded in the last few years was because oil prices went up. And what happened was a resource that wasn't economic to develop became economic to develop. The same thing should have happened here. When prices doubled, a lot of development that wasn't economic became economic, but all that passed Alaska by because the entire increase in price would have been taxed away.
Panelists, this person asks, since SB 21 passed, investment is up sharply. The production decline is now nearly flat, best performance in 12 years, and there are thousands of new jobs. Why shouldn't SB 21 be given a chance to work, especially since ACES did nothing to stem the production decline?
Well,
under ACES, the facts are the facts. You had all-time highs in jobs, all-time highs in investment, all-time highs in the number of companies doing business in Alaska. Under SB 21, you have just about the same number of people working on the North Slope. I think you maybe have 100 more today than you did when ACES was in effect. So you got virtually the same number of people working. You have investment levels that are probably about the same, maybe slightly higher. They were going up every year under ACES. Here's the thing we lost. So you've got virtually the same, but you still have production plummeting under Senate Bill 21. This is irrefutable. You've got Governor Parnell saying, who's got every interest in the world to say production's going up. He puts together his team of experts. He consults with the oil industry. They say, sorry, production's going down 45% in the next decade. That's including all the new investment. That's including all the new projections. That's what they're saying. BP saying it's going down. Conoco saying it's going down. So what you have is you have a situation where you had virtually the same amount of investment, same amount of jobs, but what you have is a system where we're getting billions of dollars less. It's not in Alaska's interest. It's a bad deal for Alaskans. A great deal for the oil industry, terrible deal for Alaskans.
And the notion that we have somehow arrested the decline rate is an artifact of the oil industry's manipulation of their investments. The Department of Revenue says they shifted their drilling of workover wells out of the period preceding the 2013 session in order to make it look like they got a bigger bump afterwards. Janet Weiss of BP admitted that they had shifted their investments and that had not produced any new oil. It was just getting the oil sooner.
Bill left out one thing of his all-time highs, and that was the all-time high of state subsidies to pursue the exploration of oil in areas that we didn't know where it was, at the disincentive of producing it in areas and going and producing it in areas that we didn't know where it was. When you talk about the state's fiscal situation, we have been paying $400 million in subsidies. So yeah, ACES takes in a lot of revenue, but then it gives a lot back out. It's a redistribution system. Takes from the rich, gives to the poor, but the poor aren't producing. The poor aren't bringing oil on. We know the oil is in the existing fields. We know there is additional oil there in the small reservoirs. We know it takes economics to go produce them. That's what SB 21 is designed to do. It's designed to go get the oil we know and not chase after the oil we don't know. It's designed for the state not to give the credits, not to give the level of credits that were given under ACES. It's an economically rational system that over the next 30 years produces more revenue from the state than ACES does. Given where we are from a fiscal situation, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we need to be finding ways to grow revenue. We need to go get the oil where we know it is, as opposed to chasing and paying money and giving subsidies to people to go chase the oil where we don't know it is.
Well, I'll just repeat two things I said briefly. One, until this referendum issue is resolved, I don't think the companies have even had a chance to think about exactly what they'll do with this.
Please share the realities of the goal of maintaining a level playing field internationally in oil and Alaska's role in this. What does vote no do? What does vote yes do in the international marketplace? I'm assuming what the questioner is asking is how does a yes vote or no affect our international competitiveness? Oh, but feel free to give your own interpretation.
Well, I touched on it a little when I first started in my opening statement. You know, you can look all across the world at what the government take is, and you have companies who have invested in Alaska, who have invested in Venezuela, where they have a 95% tax rate, had their assets confiscated, invested in Russia, where they have a 90%+ tax rate, had their assets confiscated, invested in China with a 90% tax rate, Kazakhstan 90% tax rate, Argentina with an 80% tax rate, Norway with a 78% tax rate, Iraq where they get $2 a barrel in profit. In Alaska, the tax rate's much lower than those under ACEs, much lower than those. Alaska was competitive. But here's the thing. You're asking the wrong question, because the question is, when you take out a lease in the state of Alaska, you have a legal obligation to produce on that lease when you can make a reasonable profit. The courts have said, reasonable profit, that's 10 to 30% rate of return. They're making 123% rate of return. Their leases obligate them to produce under ACEs now, without any incentives, without any more incentives. You don't have to give tax breaks, and that's the fundamental error that we're making in this whole discussion.
Okay, thank you. I guess we're into a pattern of everybody having a chance at the questions, but...
Go ahead, guys.
Okay.
Well, if you look at who Alaska competes, Alaska competes with other jurisdictions that have similar risk-reward balances in terms of reserves, prices, costs, other geological risk, institutional systems. Alaska doesn't compete with Azerbaijan. It has fabulous resources and low risk. It doesn't compete with Kazakhstan, doesn't compete with Venezuela. It competes with North Dakota, Texas, the Gulf of Mexico, California, Australia, Brazil. If you look at the jurisdictions Alaska competes with, under ACEs, the government, during the time ACEs was in effect, the government take, again, was 10 to 15 percentage points higher in Alaska than in these jurisdictions Alaska competes with. That amounted to $1.5 billion to $2 billion more they could make in these other places.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just chime in. I come back again to the fact that we have this self-centered attitude that suggests that our tax rate makes a big difference in the broad scheme of things. Everything we know suggests that it only makes a tiny difference. And all the research indicates, all our own experience indicates that. And Roger was talking about North Dakota's development being a consequence of rising oil prices. Well, it wasn't just that, and he knows. It was the technological developments that occurred at the same time that made this resource accessible at reasonable cost. So although those factors enter into the calculation, taxes are only a very small factor and by no means the one that is going to pop out as the signal out of all the other noise.
Roger, Brad, you can briefly.
Bill made one comment that I think is worth noting, and that is that we ought to be pursuing the oil companies for failure to develop. There have been 15 governors in this state. There have been many more attorney generals in this state. None of them have ever taken that position. None of them have ever pursued oil companies. Why not? To loser. I tried those cases when I lived in Oklahoma and was practicing law in Oklahoma. You lose them. You lose them if the oil company can demonstrate that they have reasonable opportunities elsewhere and that the opportunity you have on the current lease is not living up to that standard that you have elsewhere in the world. You just lose them. So we can talk about doing that. We can talk about chasing down that rabbit hole. It doesn't give you money at the end of the day. And what this state needs going forward is it needs money. It needs a rational oil tax system that increases investment, increases production, and increases revenue. That's what the legislature was doing when they developed SB 21. So we can talk about these things. We can talk about it's our oil. We can talk about we're going to sue them. We can talk about we're going to go drill. But we don't have the right to do any of that. And we lose if we try to pursue that. We need to be realistic about what we're facing. We need to be realistic that we cannot afford the spending that we've engaged in. We need to be realistic about increasing revenue.
Okay,
that's
thank
what SB 21 does.
Thank you. What is the planning horizon for oil development? Could the passage of SB 21 even possibly affect the decision-making process for projects currently being developed this season?
Could the structure of ACEs have affected the decision-making process for development this season, either negatively or positively?
Well, we know that SB 21 has already affected the decision-making process because they have cut back investment when the legislature was considering it, and when the legislature passed it, they increased investment. And Janet Weiss acknowledged that the work would have been done anyway. She said, quote, "It's not that it wouldn't have gone forward eventually, but this is the way we can reduce the decline faster." And reducing the decline faster influences the climate preceding this vote on this referendum.
Well, comparing SB 20 right now, Scott Goldsmith's report and the administration's report both say that at current prices and costs, SB 21 bring in about the same amount of money. Now, as prices go up, the tax rates under ACEs go up relatively. As costs go up, the tax rates under SB 21 go up relatively. You know, what's going to happen in the future, no one knows. I mean, in terms of cost, but I can tell you most companies, if you look at future prices, think prices are going to go down. But they could very well be wrong. In terms of the horizon, I would expect, you know, probably, you know, I think what happens, regardless of tax rates, under SB 21, if producers have the upside potential, again, they don't know what prices are going to be, so they look at projects, look at project viability over a spectrum of prices, and if you can get a lot of money when prices are high, that can drive investment. And I would expect the outcome of that process would start to materially surface in about 5 years once this issue gets resolved.
Thank you. This is just a real short question. I'm looking for a short answer from somebody who knows. Is the massive no ad campaign considered a tax credit for the oil companies?
It's not supposed to be, but we never audit those things. At least we don't audit them for years, so who knows?
The answer is no.
Thank you. My friends who are current employees with an oil company say they will lose their jobs if this repeal passes. True?
Well, some of them will lose their jobs in the normal course of affairs, and some of them will get better jobs, and things change. Will the passage of the approval of the referendum make a big difference in that regard? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
The oil industry ran a pretty expensive ad campaign during the ACEs debate called The Faces of ACEs. And they claimed all these people were losing jobs because of ACEs, and it turned out that many of them were false. In fact, we had some people come down to Juneau to talk to us as legislators and say, "Hey, I don't want to lose my job because of ACEs." And when we asked them, we found out that they had just come up from the lower 48 and gotten jobs under ACEs.
Yeah, the oil industry is spending $100 a voter to influence this election.
It's the other side's turn.
As somebody who's gone through oil downsizing, I can say yes. There will be marginal losses in employment if investment goes down. Investment will go down if we repeal SB 21 and retain ACEs. There will be losses at the margin because investment will go down. That's just the way it happens. It's not bad. It's not cruel. It's not somebody's trying to punish somebody. It just happens. Investment goes down. Employment goes down.
Or they can keep their job if they agree to go to North Dakota or Texas, where the companies, they can make a profit.
Assuming SB 21 had been enacted 10 years ago, is there any single year between then and now that SB 21 would have resulted in more tax revenue to the state than ACEs would have?
No, no, no.
I have a handout outside. You can get it. You can look. It's page 3, and there's a chart. And every single year, Alaska would have lost money under SB 21. In some years, billions of dollars.
So the answer to that is actually we don't know. Because if SB 21 had been enacted 10 years ago, there would have been increased levels of investment. There would have been increased production and increased revenue. We don't know what the past would have been had we had SB 21 earlier. We do know, under ACES, that we're facing a situation in which the state is on a path it can't sustain. That much we know for sure. And we do know that after analyzing the issue and after looking at the alternatives, the legislature passed SB 21 as a revenue response to that. We know that. So it really, we don't know the past, what SB 21 might have done. We do know the future, where we're headed under ACES.
And we also know they bring in the same amount of money in FY 14.
Wasn't it profits from oil portfolios outside Alaska that developed our North Slope? Doesn't money go to where profit margins are most competitive?
Well, you know, again, when you take out, I know Brad doesn't want to believe this, he's an oil company attorney who fought against us taking away Point Thompson. He said before that, you know, you never win these cases. Well, guess what? He lost Point Thompson. And that's the only reason that the second largest undeveloped field in North America is being developed, because the state finally said, enough is enough. We're not going to let you warehouse that gas and oil for another 30 years, just like you did. We're not going to let you warehouse that for another 27 plans of development. So he lost the case, and because of that, they're spending billions of dollars, billions right now, to develop Point Thompson. So the fundamental issue is, if you take out a lease in Alaska, guess what? You got to develop it. You can't just sit on it and then come back to the legislature and say, you know what? Give me more tax breaks. Give me more tax breaks. Yeah, I can make 123% rate of return. Yeah, I can make billions of dollars in profit, but I want more. Guess what? When you take out a lease in the state of Alaska, I don't know what cases he's reading, but every single case that I've read all across the state, and the case he lost in Alaska, proves exactly the opposite of what he's saying.
Actually, that case went to settlement, not to decision, so I don't know exactly how you count wins and losses. But let me tell you who did lose in that case. Who did lose in that case was the state of Alaska. And why the state of Alaska lost in that case is because we have now directed $2 billion of investment to a field that's going to produce 10,000 barrels a day of oil, instead of $2 billion of investment to fields that would have produced double, triple, quadruple of that. We don't know, the state doesn't have enough knowledge to know how to drive investment. That's what producers do. That's what investors do. And when we try to drive them to a certain field, when we try to drive them and say, you have to produce out of Point Thompson and only get 10,000 barrels a day out of that, when we could have had more if we'd invested it someplace else, that's a loss for Alaska.
Well, I guess what the questioner is asking is, isn't it morally right that we let the BP, Conoco, and Exxon take their profits out of Alaska and invest them elsewhere, since our oil fields were developed with profits that were generated elsewhere? That's not exactly true. A lot of it was based on borrowed money. But let's assume for argument that that's the case. Does it make sense for Alaska to go along with that if we don't have to? Is there some moral reason we should say, as Senator Stedman says, push this money across the table to the oil companies? No, there isn't. That's not what's best for Alaska. What's best for Alaska is to make sure that we have the resources to diversify our economy and to stretch out the period of adjustment, which, as Mr. Keithley says, is going to have to come. Let's not do it in a one fell swoop next year, as he would like to do.
Roger, did you want to say something on that, or should we move on? Okay, fine. We'll do just a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap it up. By voting no on SB 21, what is the incentive to return to the table to produce a real fix to our tax scheme?
Well, SB 21 needs very little fixes. I can think of one fix. But right now, the government take under SB 21 for the new oil is about exactly in line with government norms. And for the old oil, it's a little bit high. That would be one thing, you know, to think about fixing down the road. The other issue is having a bifurcated system of having one set of taxes for one kind of fields, another set of taxes for another. What it does is drive investment from one kind to the other for reason of tax, which is not efficient. But those are small problems. SB 21 has done a splendid job of ameliorating the problem of excessive government take on the low end, and makes it much more in line with government norms, so investors can earn here what they earn in other places, and again should invest here like they invest in other places.
I think it's the incentive to amend SB 29 or 21 will come from the oil companies, because we're going to hear them say, if not next year, certainly the year after, that, well, if you want a gas line, we've got to have another change to give us more profits on the oil, so we can, and that's where the pressure for change in SB 21 is going to come if voters reject the referendum.
I'll be real brief. If you say no, then there's going to be tremendous pressure on our budget, because here's what SB 21 does. There's sort of this hidden time bomb in it. It sets for new fields get a tax rate of about 13% net, right? It's one of the lowest tax rates in the world. The tax rate goes down every single year. It's a ticking time bomb. In fact, what we're doing is we're setting up a situation where new fields have a negative present value for the state. In other words, for the state of Alaska, the state actually loses money if the oil companies produce, because we're paying out credits and we're getting so little back in return. So there will be tremendous pressure on the legislature, but it won't happen for years. And we'll be broke at that time. We'll be broke in about 8 years, according to Ledger Research, if we keep SB 21. At that time, look for raids on your permanent fund, look for raids on income tax, look for sales tax. They're already starting to talk about it.
I think I'll make this the final question. Why have the oil companies given $12 million to maintain SB 21 when the opposition has less than $1 million raised? Why are oil companies so scared?
Oh, I don't think the oil companies are scared. I think the oil companies realize the resource potential of Alaska. I think they realize the potential to continue to develop additional oil in this state. And I think that they see SB 21 as a way that provides them an incentive to continue to bring investment to the state and continue to produce. They are investing the money in the public campaign to try to educate Alaskans on what the opportunity is. And I would do the same thing if I were in business. I would try to help people understand the opportunity that's in front of them if they retain a tax structure that keeps me investing in the state. They have infrastructure here, they have people here, and they have resources here. They want to stay, but it needs to be economic and it needs to be competitive for them to stay.
You know, my sister-in-law asked me just a couple of days ago, she said, isn't it unfortunate that the oil companies have so much money to spend on this and our side has so little? Oil companies, we calculated that they're going to spend $100 per voter, which is more than any other initiative or referendum has attracted ever before in Alaska. But I responded to my sister-in-law and I said, you know, Kim, it just wouldn't be fair if we had the same amount of money as they do, because we have the facts and they don't.
You know, the oil companies are doing their job. Their job is to maximize the profits for their shareholders. I don't begrudge them for that, but how much would you spend to keep billions of dollars in tax breaks? You know, they're acting as rational investors by spending millions of dollars to make billions of dollars in profits. It's the easiest money they'll make. But our job as legislators, our job as Alaskans, is to follow the Constitution and make sure that we get the maximum value for our resource. We're not doing that with SB 21. We're giving it away and getting nothing in return.
Well, I just fail to see how 200,000 barrels a day going through taps 15 years from now is maximizing the benefit of the resource to future Alaskans.
Okay. With that, if I'd like to again invite you to give our panelists a hand.
This is KSKA Anchorage. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with State Senator Bill Willikowski, economist Greg Erickson, consultant Brad Keithley, and petroleum economist Roger Marks. This is KSKA Anchorage. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with State Senator Bill Willikowski, economist Greg Erickson, consultant Brad Keithley, and petroleum economist Roger Marks. It was moderated by Gunnar Knapp of the Institute of Social and Economic Research and hosted by Alaska Common Ground. This debate and forum on the oil tax referendum was recorded at the Wilder Marston Theater on July 23rd and was edited for broadcast at this time on KSKA Anchorage. The full debate is on our website at alaskapublic.org.